Welcome to the Air Force Doctrine Podcast. My name is Nicholas Underwood. On this episode, I had the extraordinary opportunity to sit down with General James Slife, who was recently promoted to the Vice Chief of Staff of the Air Force. In our conversation, General Slife discusses the why behind the changes airmen are seeing in our force, and he outlines the new Air Task Force organization model powered by airmen who embody a culture of wingman, leader, warrior. Please join us for this incredibly insightful interview with our new Vice Chief of Staff. General Slife, thank you so much for being here today. I understand that you are a very busy man, so you taking the time to talk to us today is humbling for me and for the LeMay Center, so thank you.
Thanks. It's a privilege to have the opportunity to spend a little time with you and get to talk to you and through you to your audience. You're right, I am busy, but you know, one of the most important things that leaders at every echelon can learn to do is distinguish between the urgent and the important. And much of what goes on inside the A3 is urgent. This is important. And every one of us has to deliberately carve time out of our schedule to do the important things, even if they're not urgent. Investing in the leaders that are kind of coming along after us is probably the most important thing any of us can do at any point in time. So I'm really happy to have the opportunity to be here. And I just say thanks to you for giving me the opportunity to talk to you.
Absolutely, sir. A lot of changes happening right now in the Air Force. Pivotal, large organizational changes. We see Secretary Kendall's LOEs. One of those certainly is organization. But we see MCA coming. Multi-capable airman concept's been developed. ACE has been developed. F4GEN, and now ATFs. I thought we may talk about kind of what are the ATF white paper walks us through in terms of how we got to where we are and where we need to be.
I think the way I would put the changes that we're executing today under Secretary Kendall and General Alvin's leadership, I would put them into context by describing the strategic environment that we're in. Strategic environment, which is made up of the threat, it's made up of the kind of international relations landscape, it's domestic politics. I mean, all those things come to play in describing the strategic environment. From time to time, the strategic environment fundamentally shifts under our feet. When that happens, organizations will privilege different attributes in order to be successful in the environment as it has shifted. And so every environmental shift means that the attributes that are most prized will change. We have to adjust ourselves to accommodate those attributes that are the ones that are going to be important in the environment that we find ourselves in. And I would say that in the last half century, there have been four of these substantial shifts in the strategic environment. The first one was the end of the Vietnam War. As the Vietnam War ended, we found ourselves in a different environment facing rearmed, technologically capable, and numerically superior Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact in Eastern Europe. And so that was a very different threat than what we had been dealing with in Vietnam. That's a shift in the strategic environment. It meant that we had to make some adjustments to be effective in that environment. The second one was the end of the Cold War. When the Cold War ended, clearly the strategic environment that had prevailed, framed around the pacing threat of the Soviet Union, that was no longer the world we were in. We were in a different world. And so the attributes required for us to succeed once again changed at the end of the Cold War. The third one was 9/11. On 9/11, our national priorities changed, our national focus changed, our conception of what the biggest threats to the United States were changed. We went to war in Afghanistan, later Iraq, and those counterterrorism, counter-VEO, counterinsurgency wars that followed 9/11 required different attributes than what we needed at the end of the Cold War. And so we had to adjust for that. And then finally, I'd say we are at a fourth one of those strategic inflection points today. It's characterized by things like irregular warfare, disruptive technologies, peer competitors, emerging domains of operations. Those things all are characteristic of the environment that we're in with our pacing strategic competitor, which is China, And the attributes that we have optimized for over the, certainly the post-Cold War era and even the post-9/11 era, those attributes may not be the attributes that are required for us to be most competitive in the environment that we're in today. And so this is why the Secretary has initiated this re-optimizing for great power competition effort. It's really all about identifying the attributes that we need to be successful in the years ahead, and then ensuring that the Air Force is aligned against those attributes. It's a pretty exciting time. Frankly, I would say that this has the potential to be the most significant set of changes inside the Air Force over the course of my career, certainly, and my career predates the end of the Cold War, but even longer than that, maybe since the foundation of the Air Force. There may be some hubris in saying that, but if there is, there's not a lot of hubris in saying that. I mean, I really do think these are some of the most significant changes that we will have ever seen in the Air Force. And so it's an exciting time to be around. There's no shortage of work to do, but that's okay. It's vital work that needs to be done. I think all of my colleagues and I that have anything to do with this feel a sense of privilege for having the opportunity to be a part of this.
What I'd like to kind of summarize there is, so when we're looking at multi-capable airmen mission command, these are concepts and changes holistically across the Air Force in order to meet these attributes, such as disruptive technologies, peer competition, irregular warfare. So those kind of align there. You've mentioned previously that the shift to 9/11, one of the attributes we optimized for, at least organizationally, was flexibility. And that put us in a position that might have been right at the time, but has led to a lot of the changes we see now, particularly with the ATF and F4 Gen. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's a fair characterization of it. When I talk about in the aftermath of 9/11, we optimized for flexibility, it was because we were in an era of all in on the wars post 9/11. And when we went all in, we found ourselves demanding more out of the Air Force than we were really structured to provide. And the way that we dealt with that was by creating a great deal of flexibility in how we could deploy the Air Force by disaggregating our units. For example, we didn't deploy logistics readiness squadrons. We didn't deploy civil engineering squadrons. What we did was we disaggregated our squadrons into smaller and smaller, what are called unit type codes, UTCs, that describe a bit of capability. So you might have a unit type code for 2 7-level firefighters, or one of the UTCs we have in the Air Force right now is a UTC for a dog handler, a dog, and a bin of dog food. That is a UTC. And so what that means, I mean, it gives us great flexibility because now we don't have to deploy a security forces squadron when we want a dog and a dog handler. Now all we have to do is deploy the dog and the dog handler. And so this disaggregating a security forces squadron into these smaller and smaller UTCs gave us a great deal of flexibility. And so that was valued for a period of time. But what that creates is in the deployed environment, it creates units that are made up of these fragments of units back home, right? And so we don't deploy security forces squadron. We deploy a UTC out of this security forces squadron at Little Rock and that security forces squadron at Barksdale and this other one at Malmstrom or whatever. And it's a bunch of airmen that show up downrange together and we say, hey, congratulations, you guys are an expeditionary security forces squadron. And, you know, there's a great deal of flexibility in that, but those airmen have never met each other. They've never trained together. They haven't gone through any certification process together. And so you're expecting them to do all of that in the deployed environment. That has been reasonably successful when the deployed environment required us to operate out of large main operating bases relatively free from adversary attack. And you can afford to figure out your teammates and figure out the unit and that kind of stuff once you're deployed. You can afford to do that when you're not being regularly attacked and you're at a large main operating base and things like that. When you look at the strategic environment as it exists today and what we may be called on to do and certainly need to be prepared to call on to do, which is to get up and deploy right now, to go fight right now in a highly contested environment, I don't think we can do that with a pickup team. I mean, I think we have concluded that we need coherent teams organized around the mission that have trained together, that have exercised together, that have certified together, that know each other's strengths, can help fill in each other's weaknesses, and fight and win as a mission-centric team. I think that's kind of where we have to be in the environment that we're in today.
Yes, sir. And so transitioning from the UTC deployment model to one in which the entire unit or a unit of action goes forward, the ATF white paper, it actually defines those four components that unit of action, and by unit of action in this sense, the capability to execute a mission, there are four basic overall components that is outlined in that. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about that.
Yeah. So if you think of any unit that ought to be able to get up and deploy and go fight, really the four elements that you need in that unit are you need a command element. So think of a commander, a deputy commander, a command chief, a staff, an A staff. And so that command element is really required to provide purpose and direction to the organization as a whole. So you've got a command element. The second thing you need is the mission generating elements. And so it might be a fighter squadron. It might be a special warfare squadron. It might be a airborne early warning squadron. It might be a reconnaissance squadron. Those mission generation force elements are the pieces of the organization that actually go out and execute mission on a day-to-day basis. And so you need a command element. You need these mission generation elements. So if you think of, for example, an expeditionary fighter squadron, pilots, maintainers, aircrew flight equipment, intel, flight management, all of those things that are required to generate and fly sorties on a day-to-day basis, that's all built into that mission generation force element. The third piece that you need is a combat support force element. A combat support force element are those things that directly enable the combat operations of the unit. And so if you think of that expeditionary fighter squadron, and we talk about the need to do the agile combat employment scheme of maneuver, that expeditionary fighter squadron needs to go someplace and operate in an austere area for some period of time and then get up and move again. We execute this agile combat employment scheme of maneuver to survive. And so when you think of that expeditionary fighter squadron, you've got maintainers, you've got pilots, you've got aircrew flight equipment, you've got all that stuff, but you don't have any security forces, you don't have any tactical comm, you don't have any logisticians, you don't have any engineers, you don't have force support, you don't have all those elements that you're going to need to actually do the agile combat employment scheme of maneuver. And so that combat support force element, and so this is a combination of all those things, a combat support force element is a single team of airmen as a team capable of doing all those things, tactical comm, the force protection, the engineering, the logistics, all that packaged together to enable the agile combat employment scheme of maneuver. So that's a combat support force element. So you've got a command element, you've got a mission generation element, you've got a combat support element, and then the last piece is a combat service support force element, which is essentially a force element providing the life support, the sustenance, bed down, and all that of the organization as a whole. And so while the CS, the combat support force element, enables the agile combat employment scheme of maneuver, your CSS force element is actually providing the base operating support at your main operating base, your bed down location, if you will. And really, it's those four force elements that make up any combat unit of action. The Air Task Force is intended to be a rotationally generated version of a unit of action. So it's rotationally generated, meaning It doesn't necessarily all come from the same base. It's not a standing organization that is just waiting for tasking. It's generated through the AF4Gen cycle. Portions of that, a command element may come from one base, a mission gen force element may come from another base, a combat service support force element may come from a different base. Those pieces, though, would be aligned in their AF4Gen phases, and they'll come together in training and exercise in order to certify together as a coherent unit of action, an air task force, and then we'll be prepared to deploy. That is the idea behind the air task force. But it's those same four basic elements, a command element, a mission gen elements, combat support, combat server support, that you have to have in our standing units of action. In other words, the rotationally generated unit of action, the air task force, is really meant to meet those rotational taskings that we get year in and year out, to go to base X and operate for 6 months or whatever. And that'll all happen with the air task force. But at the same time, you know, if we had indications that, hey, there's a crisis somewhere around the world and we have to deploy this combat wing. So you pick the combat wing, the B1 wing at Ellsworth, for example, and we say, quick, deploy the wing. Well, that wing, when it picks up and deploys, is going to need those same things. It's going to need a command element. It's going to need its B1 mission generation elements. It's going to need combat support, and it's going to need combat service support. So in many ways, it's a framework for thinking about the Lego blocks that have to come together to create a package of combat capability capable of executing combat operations under a mission command construct.
That answers the question. The white paper addresses this as well, but with the shift to ATF and the 4Gen model, are wings just force generators for ATFs? And the answer is absolutely no. They can also be picked up, but they're the standing model as well. So I think that's very interesting. With outlining the basic outline of the ATF, I want to talk a little bit about the individual units. So inside of the combat service support, the combat support elements, to pull in our multi-capable airmen concept, we would not imagine that a combat or a CS or a CSS are going to have a full unit of each individual AFSC. Is that correct? Is that really where the MCA ties in?
That's right. So over the last several decades, our AEWs have largely been modeled around our home station garrison structure. And so when you think of an MSG at Little Rock Air Force Base, for example, you've got a comm squadron, you've got a civil engineering squadron, you've got a security forces squadron, you've got a force support squadron. I mean, you have all these squadrons that make up your MSG. The challenge is that those squadrons are really heavily focused on operating Little Rock Air Force Base. We don't have any force support squadrons that are just sitting around waiting for somebody to need a force support squadron to deploy. All of our force support squadrons are largely tied up running Air Force bases someplace. Across these CS and CSS elements, the question is, how do you build a unit, a force element, however you want to describe it, that has the ability to do combat support for air task force, for a wing or whatever, but is not, well, hey, if I want to do combat support for this fighter squadron that's going out doing the ACE scheme of maneuver, I need a mini FSS, and I need a mini CES, and I need a mini LRS, and a mini CS. I mean, A, we don't have those units, and B, you couldn't afford to build a bunch of solely functional units. And so when you think about that combat support force element needed to execute the Agile Combat Employment Scheme of Maneuver, you're really talking probably somewhere between 50 and 60 airmen as a team that come from all those career fields that are needed and necessarily are going to pick up some of the skills from their teammates as they go through the force gen cycle together. Force support airman learns to drive a forklift. The forklift driver learns to lay Cat 5 cable. The Cat 5 cable person learns to refuel a generator. these airmen are far more capable than a narrow AFSC definition gives them credit for. In a combat environment, we can't have an airman sitting around saying, well, my AFSC is force support, so let me know when it's time to hand out the MREs, and that's what my AFSC allows me to do is hand out the MREs, and so I'll just be here just kind of sitting around waiting until it's time for me to do my job. I mean, that airman has got way more capability than that. I mean, but we have to train them and we have to give them an opportunity to learn those skills and practice them and exercise and all that. This looks a little like the AMC contingency response organizations. You go to a contingency response group or wing somewhere in AMC or PACAF or USAFE or wherever we have our contingency response organizations, and you'll see organizations that are built just the way I'm describing. And, you know, typically the morale is pretty high. The airmen are excited to be more closely tied to a mission and not constrained by the left and right limits of what their AFSC says they need to do. It really is this idea of mission-ready airmen or multi-capable airmen, if you use the term, but really mission-ready airmen trained together, ready to execute their mission together. Again, civil engineering is not a mission, it's a function. Aerial port is not a mission, it's a function. And so we have to bring airmen with those skills together and organize them around mission and not around function.
And since we earlier made the point that the structure of the ATF, those four components, also is desired for the standing wing, what I'd like to maybe highlight here is the multi-capable airman concept. This is not a just deployed airman concept. This is something across the Air Force. Is that accurate?
I think that is accurate. It's not entirely clear how this is all going to work out just yet, but how do you build that into our existing wing structure where we are sized around these functional squadrons, right? We have a security forces squadron and an LRS and so on and so forth. And so we're sized around those squadrons. So it's not entirely clear exactly. So how do we carve out time for airmen to train and certify outside of the confines of their AFSC? Do we build those teams? I mentioned, you know, it could be 50 to 60 airmen. Do you pull those 50 to 60 airmen out of their existing squadrons and form them into a team and let them do nothing but train? That's one way to do it. Another way to do it is, no, you leave them in their existing squadrons, but then you bring them together 1 week every month for combat skills training, or I don't know. It's not completely sorted out how that will be, but I think what is fairly well understood is that we have to build those teams of mission-ready or multi-capable airmen that are aligned to a unit's mission. We have to do that. How we're going to get there from where we are, several options on the table. I wouldn't care to bet on which one we're going to land on.
One thing I wanted to talk about is the mission generation elements. These could be made up of various platforms, various capabilities. The word composite is almost a bad word anymore, but the idea is these are purpose-built and comprised of the mission generation elements that we need to accomplish the expected role. I just want to talk a little bit about that. They're purpose-built, or the ACE doctrine note talks about tailorable force packages. And so the intent is to tie what goes into the mission generation to the predicted mission. Is that correct?
That's right. Remember, I mentioned that we have rotationally generated units of action, the Air Task Force. We also have standing units of action. And so the standing units of action, you think of the 20th Fighter Wing at Shaw, for example, that's a standing combat unit. It doesn't have any B-1s. It doesn't have any tankers. It's three F-16 squadrons at Shaw as the Mission Gen 4 element. So the standing units of action are going to look like what they look like. The rotationally generated units of action, the Air Task Force, will have the capabilities required for the mission you expect them to perform. So what I mean by that is the very term task force, the reason that term was chosen is because it is a task-organized unit. Task-organized means it's built for its purpose. It's not a standing unit. You may require an Air Task Force that is heavy on ISR capabilities. You may require one that's heavy on fighter-type capabilities. You may require one that has tankers and fighters and C-130s all in the same one. Any of those are fine. It's just dependent on what the mission requires. You're going to task organize around that. And that will necessarily create composite units. And composite units are really a good idea. It's really reflective of the way we prefer to operate. The challenge with composite units, and after Desert Storm in the early 90s, we experimented with creating composite wings. Created one at Mountain Home. We created one at Seymour Johnson. We created one at Moody. We created one at Pope. We had a number of composite wings around the Air Force. And the idea was that, hey, we're actually better with these capabilities packaged together, training together on a day-to-day basis. I mean, it's a fantastic idea. The challenge with composite standing units is they're really expensive. So you want to put B-1s at Mountain Home Air Force Base. Well, guess what? Mountain Home's hangars are built for fighter-type airplanes. And so if you want to put B-1s at Mountain Home, you got to build some hangars. And the ramp at Mountain Home is sized for fighter-type airplanes. If you want to park a bunch of B-1s at Mountain Home, you're going to need a lot more concrete on the ramp. The spare parts that go into a B-1 are different than the spare parts that go into a F-15. And so you're going to need a whole different supply warehouse. And so there's all this infrastructure required to have composite wings that is really cost prohibitive. And so we did composite wings for a bit in the 1990s, and we kind of largely walked away from it, primarily because of the cost and the logistics challenges and all the things that I've highlighted here. But we still, to this day, we build the air expeditionary wings that we build are all composite wings. And so we employ that way. What the Air Task Force concept enables you to do is it allows you to build composite units through the force gen cycle and deploy them as a composite unit. So they've actually know each other, they've trained together, they've exercised together, all of that without having to actually build the hangars at Mountain Home and pour the concrete and buy the supply chain and, you know, all the stuff that comes along with basing composite units at a single place. I think there's a lot of value in composite units. The question is, how do you build them? And I think we can build them with rotational force elements and perhaps with routine training opportunities for geographically aligned units.
I'd like to transition to talking about the command element of the ATF. This command element will include an A staff, and I think it's somewhere around 35, 40 people. I apologize, I don't have the number in front of me. That's a fairly large command unit, whereas usually the command unit was created separately and brought together, such as in the KOC or any particular AETF, or in my case, the CGSOX, something of that nature. So bringing the command unit together is definitely something that appears to be in line with our intent to utilize the mission command philosophy or the practical application of mission command. And so I thought you may talk a little bit about what you expect that command element to be doing inside of ACE or a steady state.
Yeah, so one of the things that Air Force has recognized is that we have historically not done a great job at developing airmen that understand the distinctions between line and staff organizations. In other words, a line organization, something that is a mission that has somebody whose duty title is commander in charge of it. And so a line organization is different from a staff organization. What do staffs do? Staffs help the commander with the resourcing, policy, oversight, and guidance of the organization as a whole. And so what's the difference between when your computer doesn't work, who do you call? Do you call the A6? Because A6 is comm, right? So we should call the A6 when the computer doesn't work. Well, no. The A6 is a staff organization. It's resourcing, policy, oversight, and guidance. It's not help desk. Help desk is a line function with somebody in charge of it whose duty title is commander. We got to move 5 pallets of stuff. Oh, that sounds like logistics. Maybe that's the A4's job. No, the A4 is a staff entity that helps the commander with logistics, resourcing, policy, oversight, and guidance. That's what the A4 is. Moving the pallet belongs in somebody whose job title is commander, who does a line function of moving the pallet around. Flying airplanes is not the A3's job. There's a squadron commander whose job is to fly the airplanes. The A3 helps the overall commander with resourcing, policy, oversight, and guidance. And because we haven't really distinguished between line and staff functions all that clearly, and we haven't trained airmen how to recognize what is what, and we haven't built functional staffs at levels beneath often the NAF or even the MAGCOM level, we don't understand that all that well as airmen. But this is really required in the joint world, is to understand how to operate in a clear distinction between line and staff organizations. And so you say that, you know, I think the ATF staff is generally on the order of 45, 48 people or something. You go, wow, that's kind of a big staff. Well, here's the thing. That staff work is already being done. It's just being done buried in a squadron somewhere. And so, for example, when I was a wing commander, I also was an installation commander. And so I had the mission wing, but also running the installation, all those things. And part of what an installation commander does in the Air Force is we do installation master planning. Where's the new housing going to go? Do we need a new CDC? If so, where are we going to put it? Do we have the right power lines going to it? Do we need to realign the roads to ease the traffic flow? This is all installation master planning stuff. And there are people that do installation master planning. That's resourcing, policy, oversight, guidance. That is staff work that ought to be working for a wing commander. That work is being done. Just because we haven't had an A staff at a wing doesn't mean that nobody's doing installation master planning. It's just buried in a civil engineering squadron somewhere. And so as an installation commander, if I wanted to talk to my person that helps me with installation master planning, I've got to go through a group commander and a squadron commander and a flight commander to find the person that actually does the staff work buried in a squadron somewhere. So all these things are already being done. They're just being done in the wrong places. And so by pulling the staff work up to the staff, it gives the commander more direct access to the people that are actually doing that necessary staff work, assisting the commander. And frankly, it frees commanders from this dual role of, I have to be the civil engineering squadron commander, but I also have to be the supervisor of the wing master plans, installation plans person or whatever. It actually liberates the line units to do line functions when you extract the staff functions away from that. 45 people at a 06 level staff is not at all out of line with what the other services have found normal staff organization would roughly be sized at. I think this transition to A staffs at the wing and ATF level is going to be really healthy for us in the long term, and it's going to make us better warfighters.
I appreciate that, sir. I fundamentally misunderstood what the intent there was. It certainly helps to plan, execute, and assess across the warfighting functions. It is a necessity regardless of what the wing is doing in any particular function, and I don't think I understood that. We've talked a lot about the limited resources and the transition. Sometimes airmen are going to have to be taken out of their squadron, or as we transition to these ATFs, there may be a shorthanding the base as we train up or as we go back and forth. It's a statement of do more with less, but there's a relationship here that you've talked about numerous times. And so I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk about that relationship between more mission, resources, and risk.
Yeah, this is a really, really important concept, I think, for all airmen to be able to kind of wrap their minds around. And there is a three-way relationship that is always in tension and always in balance. Always in tension and always in balance between requirements, resources, and risk. So if you draw a triangle and you put requirements at one corner, you put resources at one corner, you put risk at the third corner, those three things are always in that relationship. They're always in balance and they're always in tension. And what I mean by that is that We frequently hear people say, you can't ask people to do more with less. You can, at higher risk. The trick is to learn to articulate what that risk actually is. So, for example, I have a requirement to defend Little Rock Air Force Base. Can I defend Little Rock Air Force Base with resources that amount to one security forces airman? Can I put one security forces airman in charge of defending Little Rock Air Force Base? Yes, I can, at a very high level of risk. You can have this one airman walk around the perimeter of Little Rock Air Force Base 24 hours a day. Every time he comes by the front gate, he checks three ID cards and locks the gate behind him and keeps walking around the perimeter. And 18 hours later, he passes out from exhaustion. So we revive him and tell him, give him an IV and tell him he's got to keep going. And so you can absolutely defend Little Rock Air Force Base with one airman. We just would never accept that level of risk. And you go, okay, well, so too high of risk, not enough resources for the requirement of defending Little Rock Air Force Base. So you go, okay, well, what about with 2,000 airmen? If I had 2,000 airmen worth of resources, could I defend Little Rock Air Force Base? Absolutely. At a very, very low level of risk. I mean, they could work one day a week and have 4 days a week off. And I mean, it's no problem to defend Little Rock with 2,000 airmen. Well, what about 1,000? What about 800? What about 400? 375? 350? 342? 341? I mean, what is the difference in risk of defending Little Rock Air Force Base with a security forces squadron of 388 airmen versus 387 airmen? I mean, that's hard to be able to articulate risk in a way that, okay, when you do that, boss, here's what that risk looks like. All of the changes that we're talking about will involve this constant tension and balance between requirements, resources, and risk. We will put options in front of the Secretary of the Air Force, and it may be, let's lower the requirements, Mr. Secretary. In other words, we want less mission so that we can reduce the risk associated with something, or we can pull resources out of that. So we can reduce requirements. We might say, Mr. Secretary, we have a larger requirement here. We don't have any more resources available, so it's going to result in risk, and this is what that risk looks like. Or we may say, Mr. Secretary, we think that we don't want to assume any more risk. We want to do more requirements. We think you're going to have to go to Congress and get us more resources, more money to do that. I mean, this conversation will play out over and over and over. Every one of these decisions will be some rebalancing of that iron triangle of requirements, resources, and risks that the Secretary is going to work his way through, and we're going to help tee up those decisions for him. So when you look at places in the Air Force where back to the combat wing is our deployable unit of action, there are places in the Air Force where our combat wings don't have what they need to be able to get up and go and be prepared to fight right now. I mean, that exists inside the Air Force. And so the decisions that we have to make are, well, does that mean we have too many combat wings because we can't resource them all? So maybe we need fewer combat wings. We'd say, no, we don't need fewer combat wings. Okay, well, we need more resources to fill out those combat wings so they have all the pieces they need to be able to get up and deploy and fight. Okay, well, that's a resource thing. Maybe the answer is, well, we need all the combat wings we have, but we're not getting any more money. So what's the only variable left? Risk. And so we need to take airmen out of this organization over here in order to put them into this combat organization to make it whole. We're going to take risk over here at this other place. Every one of those is going to be a decision. And, you know, conceptually, it's not hard to understand that there's three things and they're always in tension. But actually figuring out what risk looks like and how you articulate it is really, really challenging.
Yes, sir. We struggle with trying to define prudent risk in the Mission Command Doctrine, and we couldn't do it. And our ultimate conclusion was that's got to be a commander. commander has to look at his unit, has to look at his mission, him or her, look at the mission and define prudent risk at their level, because it is that constant tension. We touched on briefly, we talked a little bit about culture. And I got the opportunity to interview Chief Sells when we were talking about multi-capable airmen. And he had this idea that maybe one day, every, just the same as any every Marine talks about being a Marine first, they also talk about, he had a vision that one day every airman calls himself multi-capable first. And we start to see that culture of airmen really become defined under this multi-capable term. And so you've talked a lot about culture today, and a lot of the essays we're getting for our essay contest coming up talks about what is the culture of the Air Force? How does mission command change our culture? And so I thought I'd give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about the culture of who we are and the vision you see for us.
Wingman, leader, warrior. I mean, that's who we say we ought to be. That ought to be our culture. And so you look at that and you go, okay, well, it's one thing to say it. How do you inculcate that? Well, one thing is you give airmen an opportunity to operate as a wingman, for example. What does that mean? Well, being a wingman is you're taking care of your teammate, right? Being a good wingman means you're taking care of your teammate. Well, to take care of your teammate, you have to have a team. So number one, we have to build teams of airmen. That reinforces this idea of being good wingmen. But if I have never met you before and we deploy together and it's like, hey, congratulations, you guys are both part of the Expeditionary Security Forces Squadron. Here's Underwood, here's Slife. You guys are a team. I've never met you before. I've never worked with you. It's hard for me to be a good wingman if I don't know the first thing about you and the first time I meet you is in combat. We have to put airmen into teams where they train, exercise, certify, deploy together as teams, be good wingmen. Being good leaders, what does that mean? Well, leadership flourishes when you create more leaders and not less leaders. When you create functional stovepipe organizations, there's only one person that gets to be in charge of that organization. That's a recipe for creating few leaders. What we want is organizational constructs that encourage leadership, that create more leaders, that give leadership opportunities to people. So here on our team of mission-ready airmen or multi-capable airmen, here on our team, I am the sole forklift driver. And so I get an opportunity to lead my team in learning. It doesn't mean I'm in charge of the team, but I'm leading the training of how to operate a forklift safely and effectively. And you are the subject matter expert on generators. You're the only one we got. I don't have a whole squadron of civil engineers. I don't have a whole squadron of electricians. You're the one. And so your opportunity to lead is in helping us understand basic generator operation and maintenance so that all of us as a team can work together to keep this generator online so that we have power in our op center tent, for example. That's creating more opportunities for leadership. And then warriors. How do we inculcate this idea that as airmen, we're warriors? How do we do that? Well, for one thing, you give people the opportunity to train like warriors and to solve warrior problems. And if the only problem I'm ever asked to solve is what time do I have to set my alarm clock so I can show up on time for guard mount so I can go out and check ID cards at the front gate, that's not a warrior culture. That's a garrison culture. I'm checking ID cards at the front gate. That's what my job is. That's not what a warrior, a security forces airman, a defender, that's not their warrior job, is to check ID cards. But if that's all we ever ask them to do, we're not creating that warrior culture. And so when you talk about culture, we already know what it is. We talk about it. It's in the Airman's Creed. And we talk about being wingmen, leaders, and warriors. I'm an American airman. That's what all that means. But how do we put our airmen into organizational constructs and give them opportunities to practice the Airman's Creed, to actually be what we say we are as an Air Force? And I think there's a fantastic opportunity for us to do that.
I meet a lot of the PME around here and a lot of airmen at AFA conferences, and there's a tendency to look at every one of these elements as a different initiative, but they are all glued together in order to adapt our force holistically to the attributes that you talked about of the current security environment. So they are not individual pieces. They are all glued together and all important. So, sir, in closing here, let me thank you. I'd like to go out on your last statement here, so I want to thank you for being here again. This has been fantastic. Just in closing, I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk directly to the FGOs and our senior NCOs, which is kind of our primary audience here. What are the big leadership lessons learned or the big leadership advice you have for leading an organization through a large change?
I think the field grade officers and the senior NCOs are the critical echelon in the Air Force. The changes that are underway, that we're talking about, that we're thinking about inside the Air Force, the generals are not the important part of that. The colonels are not the important part of that. It's the majors and lieutenant colonels, senior NCOs in every organization that is either going to make this succeed or fail. And for that audience, what I would say is really understanding and appreciating this iron triangle of requirements, resources, and risk, and being able to think about that and articulate that. It's not hard to complain about a lack of resources. That's not hard at all. I mean, we've been practicing that our whole careers. I have studied military history for a long period of time. I've yet to come across one commander ever in the course of human history that's ever said, I'm good. I've got everything I need. I don't need any more money. I don't need any more people. The nature of leadership at any level is in balancing the requirements, the resources, and the risk. Nobody ever thinks they have everything they need to be completely comfortable. You're always going to be uncomfortable with a lack of resources or too much requirements or too much risk. You're always going to be uncomfortable with that. And so learning how to deal with that, learning how to talk about it and think about it and not just kind of cross your arms and say, well, I'm being asked to do more with less. That's not helpful. Figuring out how to balance these things in a way that allows you to be successful in the mission is really the art of leadership at the field grade and senior NCO levels. I would highlight that. And the other thing that I would tell leaders at this echelon is that every organization experiences change in the same way that individuals experience grief. And it makes sense because you're grieving whatever the change is. You're grieving a new way of doing business, a new set of organizational structures, a new power hierarchy, a new who's in charge. Hey, man, I've worked my whole career to be a flight commander, and now all of a sudden you put me in a new organization. We don't have flights anymore, and now I don't know who's in charge. And, I mean, there's all this discomfort and anxiety around change, and just like individuals grieving, organizations will go through all five stages of grief when they're asked to change. Organizations will go through denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And as leaders, particularly the field grade officers, the senior NCOs, recognizing that that's what's going on in the organization is grieving. And it's going to manifest as denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And you have to lead through that. The best way to lead through this grieving process is you have to be able to explain the why. People want to get to the what. What are we going to do? And they want to get to the how. How are we going to do it? But they can't get to the what or the how until they first understand the why. And so as leaders at the very cutting edge of the Air Force, our senior NCOs and our field grade officers, understanding that you've got to lead through change, you've got to lead through this grieving process, and you have to be able to explain the why, really, really critical leadership skills at that echelon. But it's hard, and it's going to be hard, but hard is not impossible. And our comparative advantage vis-a-vis our pacing challengers are our airmen. The airmen are our comparative advantage. No matter how hard it is, our airmen always find a way to make it work. And this will be no different than any other major change we've gone through in the history of our Air Force. It will succeed because our airmen will make it succeed. And that's an encouraging thing for a guy that's got way less runway left ahead of me than I've got behind me. I mean, statistics would suggest that I'm way closer to the end of my life than the beginning of my life, and that I'm way closer to the end of the career than the beginning of the career. But I'm not worried about any of that because I know that airmen, the NCOs, the officers coming into the Air Force today are going to lead us through this change, and it's going to be fine.
That's going to do it for this week's podcast. The show is recorded, edited, and produced by the LeMay Center's Doctrine Outreach Section. Special thanks to General Slife, the LeMay Center, and Air University. As always, the views expressed by our guest or host are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Air University, the Air Force, or any government agency. I'm Nicholas Underwood. We will see you next time.